From living alone to living with others.
You know, we used to live in tribes of 50 to 200 people. It's not really very natural to be living alone in the way that we do. And so I'm hoping my book will be a practical guide for something that's much bigger.
That's Anna Marie Pluhar. We get her do's and don'ts on finding and keeping housemates. Her book is Shared Housing. And what if you or the person you live with has a hoarding problem?
All of us can sort of fall prey to some of the cognitive distortions that we see in people that are struggling with compulsive hoarding. And it really becomes diagnostically a problem when you're bringing in more stuff than your house can hold.
That's Dr. Robin Zasio, psychologist and consultant to the TV show Hoarders. We'll talk with her about her new book, The Hoarder in You, How to Live a Happier, Healthier, Uncluttered Life. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It's a common thing for young people to live with housemates when they're in college. But more people than college students are moving in with each other these days. Some are doing it because they've lost their homes or jobs in the recession. Some homeowners are renting rooms to tenants because they need help in paying the mortgage. And some people are just looking for companionship in a society where families are far flung and friends are hard to find. Living together can help people live lighter on the planet, too. But it can be tough to find someone or some place you're compatible with. Too often, shared housing ends up in bitterness and ruptured relationships. My guest, Anna Marie Pluhar, has been living with housemates for many years. She's seen the good, the bad, and the ugly about living with others. Now she shares her hard-won knowledge about how to do it right in her new book, Shared Housing. It's a guidebook on finding and keeping good housemates. Anna Marie Pluhar, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's delightful to be here. Thank you.
Now, in this book, Shared Housing, a guidebook for finding and keeping good housemates, I think I heard about it in the context of a lot of older people are, in fact, beginning to, shared housing is something that we, most of us, remember from our college days, but now it's becoming more general. A lot of older people are beginning to do this for a number of different reasons, one of which is, of course, the Great Recession. What's your sense of what's going on out there in the shared housing marketplace?
Well, it's hard to get solid data about how many people are sharing housing, but it's certainly anecdotally I'm hearing about it on a lot of different levels. So we have people who are sharing housing, as you said, older people. We have, of course, the boomerang generation, which is coming back to their parents' houses because they simply can't afford the housing costs. So there's a combination of things, the money, the companionship that sharing housing offers, that people are beginning to look to. And as I go around talking to people, it's very interesting. There's a group of people who will say to me, oh, you know, I've thought about doing that when I retire. And I think that there will be more and more of us who figure out how to share housing costs and have the kind of companionship that when you're underneath the same roof you have, it's so different from living alone and going out for companionship.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. For much of my adult life, I did share housing with others, and then I found I was done with it. I just gave up in disgust. It seemed like it was very hard to live with others and that the conflicts were very difficult to negotiate. And you talk about this being a negotiated relationship. Could you tell us a cautionary tale from your own experience?
Well, I do have a few cautionary tales. I think that the biggest issue that happens in the places where I've gotten myself into trouble is when I've been desperate for a housemate, when I felt like, ooh, I really was dependent on that income and nobody was going to come along and it's winter time and so on. So I rented my room to a young woman who said she was going to school, and what I was doing was offering a space on a temporary part-time basis. And soon after that, I was going away for a period of time over the Christmas holidays, and I was glad to have somebody in the house who could feed the cat. It's one of the advantages of having housemates. And when I came back, she'd moved her boyfriend in. And we hadn't talked about that. And, I was like, oh, I'm not so sure about that. But they kept to themselves. And then they got behind on the rent. And one thing led to another, and I had to ask her to move out. And I did it pretty quickly. But that was a case where I sort of overcame my own little cautionary, oh, what's going on here? Where are the references? I didn't ask for references. It's one of the things I absolutely, it's like required. People should ask for references both directions. And so the cautionary tale really has to do with the selection process. I think that mature people can live comfortably with each other. There's adjustments, perhaps, but it's the selection process. And I could interview you and ask you what it was you didn't like about sharing housing later on, if I may.
Yeah, that's a very good question, I think. I loved the place where it was. I was going in a situation, and I think this is one of my questions, too. I came into a situation, it was a very established household, and one person had been there the longest of anyone. She'd been there like already, I think, 10 years. And she was like the undisputed queen of the household, even though she didn't own the house. And I think some of the things that came between us was the issue of cleanliness. I'm more of a neat freak, and she was not at all. And and I didn't feel like I had any power, basically, which I actually didn't have any power to,
Right.
I came in the situation, I couldn't really say, I think you should do your dishes. She resented it. And so, they had interviewed me, but I don't think I really had interviewed them. I mean, I had sat down with them once, but I didn't really.
Bingo!
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, what a beautiful story. Thank you. That's exactly it. You didn't interview them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's it's a give and take. And both people need to be thinking about, oh, I'm going to be living here. Are my needs going to get met?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you, talk about maybe negotiating some of those power differentials, which I think can come about, let's say you own the house and you're sharing it with renters, or in this situation, this person, had been there for so long that she virtually owned it.
Yeah. I absolutely think that there are power differentials, and that the person in the power position, if you will, either the landlord or the person who's been there the longest, needs to become conscious of their role in that way and not flaunt it, and make space for the people who are moving in. But let me back up, because you said cleanliness was the issue there. What I say, and it's gotten even clearer since I wrote the book, but it's in the book too, is that there are critical issues that people need to have clarity and agreement on before they move in, before they've agreed to live together. And they are cleanliness, neatness, kitchen use, routines, noise, by which I mean television, radio, music in public spaces, guests, tasks, and bills.
That's a pretty comprehensive list. I like that.
It's the list, though. And it doesn't matter if you like each other. I mean, it's much better if you do like each other, of course. But there are so many different ways that people can share a house. That can be, you know, best friends forever, which is one sort of extreme. Or they can be independent satellites, recognizing that they've got an economic relationship that allows them both to live better because they're spending less for their housing. The issue here is clarity and agreement before you agree to live together. So if you had been interviewing and you had said, well, I'm a neatnik. I really like to have all the dishes cleaned before I go to bed at night or whatever it might be. And she then says, that's not a problem. Love to have you here. You've got a foot to stand on when you go back and when 2 months later she's not doing her dishes.
Oh, that's good because, you know, people aren't always honest. So,
right.
So what you would say is, you know, then you can go back. Well, yeah, then you hope you can go back. It may not work.
Then you can hope you go back. But what I'm actually hoping and what I really want is I want people to be real and honest in their interviewing process. So she looks at you and she says, I don't do that. I let my dishes pile up. That's the way it is in this house.
Right.
Then you have to make a decision. Are you moving in anyway? And if you've decided you're moving in anyway, it's a different internal experience of the person's mess.
Right. Well, now, references. You said how important they are. Here's another question. How can you trust them? I mean, isn't somebody mm-hmm. going to give you references that's going to show them in the best light?
Of course. I mean, the same thing's true of job references, right? By the way, I'm suggesting that references go both directions. It's okay to ask for a reference from an established household you're thinking of moving into, as well as vice versa. And if anybody has any problem with that, that should be a warning sign. So if you're I call them householder, the person who's in the space looking for somebody to move in. If you're the householder, you want to have two references. You want to have a reference about income, and you want to have a reference about the person as a housemate. And of course they're going to give you somebody who's going to give them a good reference. But you listen to what kind of things they talk about. So you say, Barbara Ann is thinking about moving into my house, and she gave me your name as a reference. How long have you known Barbara Ann? About a month. Met her at a bar last month. That's a very different reference from right. Known her since we were 5 years old.
Well, that's,
right?
Yeah, that is useful. And of course, you can cover all your bases and there can still be problems, but you're really talking about kind of loading the dice in favor of a good situation.
Yes. I am wanting to make sure that everybody makes a good decision for themselves about moving in. I'm starting from the premise that people are mature, well-intentioned, and just looking for a good way to live. And from that place, then it's a question of, is it a good match?
You also talk about being pretty specific, even in the ad process. So I'm going to read an mm-hmm. ad that you reproduce in the book. I think it's mm-hmm. very typical of the ads that you find. It's very short because a lot of times, you know, people don't want to write a whole lot. And by the way, I want to tell our listeners, I am talking with Anna Marie Pluhar about her book, Sharing Housing. It's a guidebook for finding and keeping good housemates. You suggest using Craigslist, so we don't really have a problem with the amount of space. You can take a lot of space. So here's the ad. $475 roommate needed to share two-bedroom apartment. Female college student seeks female roommate to share two-bedroom apartment in Haverhill. Rent is $475 each plus utilities. Looking ASAP. So, I mean, I think that is pretty typical.
It's very typical. What's wrong? So, one of the things I've realized as I think about this is that people write roommate ads as if they were real estate ads, apartment ads, and they're not paying attention to the relationship part. And what you want to have happen is you want to have, so if you're the householder writing the ad, what you want to have is you want to have somebody look at your ad and go, oh, my God, that sounds like the place for me. So you have to give some details about it. So you have to say something about what the room is like, something about what the house is like, something about who you are or the group of people, something about what you're looking for in a person, and then the details about bills and references and, you know, the financials. So many people don't do that.
So we've talked about the ad. We've talked a bit about the references. Let's talk about the interview.
Okay, so I suggest heartily that people do a little what could be called a self-assessment, personal inventory, but really sit down and think about what they must have in a home and what they can't live with. Because those two sets of understandings about yourself will help guide you in responding to ads. So, for instance, your own particular situation, I'm a neatnik. I have to have a clean kitchen. So if you have your list of what it is you must have and can't live with, that begins the process of winnowing or filtering what would be a good place for you to live. So with the interview, what I'm heartily recommending in the book is that because the ad is descriptive, and so you know something about what it is you're applying for, you then contact the person. And in contacting the householder, the two of you arrange to have a telephone interview. And in that telephone interview, you can cover the basis of, does this setup meet my must-haves, can't-live-withs? And you do that before you actually see the place.
You have some interesting do's and don'ts. Let's talk about first some of the do's. You know, there's the golden rule, of course, which I think is probably the best rule ever made for any relationships anywhere.
Of course, which is why we call it the golden rule.
Right. But what are some of the other rules for getting along?
Well, I actually call them principles, because I'm not really keen on rules, but that's personal. That's my personal must-have. I don't really like a whole lot of rules, but it's a principle. So the second one is do it while it's easy. Okay, and what this means to me is my personal formulation. What this means to me is that since you're living under the same roof, you should take care of and speak up about something which causes you a little bit of a pang when it's easy to do it. I tell a story in the book about a housemate situation where the householder had given her housemate complete free rein of the kitchen, totally adored this person, it was all good, etc. And every time this householder went to use a particular storage container that she liked a lot, she found that her housemate had already used it.
What you mean she'd used up whatever was in it?
No, it's just a container, just a storage container. I mean, this is the way little things happen in households. And every time she turned around, it was being used by her housemate, and she started to feel, and it began to become a really big issue for her internally. She's having this conversation with herself. And she finally, instead of saying it's something easily the first time, oh, you're using that container, I really love that container, it became this issue, and finally she sort of blurted to her housemate, you know, you're always using this container. And then housemate turned to her and said, oh, yeah, I really like it. Oh, I'll go buy my own. Done. So that's a do-it-while-it's-easy story. Things should be taken care of before they become an issue between you guys, because you want to be comfortable at home. Rule number three is your room is your own. In all the years that I lived in my house in shared housing, this was never an issue. But I've heard that in other houses, sometimes it is. There should be no reason why anybody else is ever in your room unless you've invited them.
Right.
So for older people who might be sharing housing by taking a room that's been occupied by a child who's now left, this means really moving out of the room completely. Not storing the Christmas decorations in the closet, you know, not doing something that causes them to want access to the room. That's no good. And then my fourth is one that I think is kind of interesting, and that is I think that housemates need to have an automatic incest taboo.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because, that surprised me. People, you know, it's very hard to kind of have principles around love and attraction, and, you know, people fall in love and go off happily. So why would you have a taboo against it?
Because it creates an unnatural sexual tension at home. You want home to be comfortable. If you're destined to go off into the sunset happily ever after, then you can have a conversation about what it means that you are housemates and you've fallen in love. But I think what often happens is that one person takes advantage of the other person. And it's inevitable that if you have started dating, sleeping with your housemate, and you don't go off into the sunset, one of you is going to lose your home. This was actually, I owe a great debt to a housemate of mine who, when he moved in, said this in the interview. He said, and we have an incest taboo, right? And I went, yes. And it was fabulous because we got close. We got really friendly. We knew a lot about each other's lives. We never spent any time outside of the house together, interestingly enough. But we lived together for 4 years, and we got to know each other really well. So this is the way to manage not getting confused, is to just have that in place like you have with your sibling.
It seems like that is a key that underlies a lot of what you say, Anna Marie Bluhar, in your book, Sharing Housing. You know, keeping things clear. And another area where this could get difficult is if parents with children are sharing housing also. So talk about, well, first talk about the upside of that, and then talk about how to negotiate, you know, the downside, which could be discipline, dealing with discipline of the child that isn't yours.
Oh, that way you mean. I thought you were talking about adult children moving at home. Yes, so parents with kids. I love the idea of single moms sharing housing or single dads sharing housing. I think that there is a huge benefit, and I think that even more the parents need to be careful in selecting each other, but because naturally, as soon as you have kids involved, you get more enmeshed with each other. And I think it's important for parents to have, single moms, to have similar ideas about discipline and rules and regs. Because, for instance, to take something totally crass, if one parent is a no TV, no screen time for my kid at all, and the other one is a, I don't care, he can play video games 24/7, they're not going to be happy living together. That's more of, you know, what you must have and what you can't live with. And they need to work out, I can't say categorically that you can only discipline your own child. I'm not sure that that's true.
Mm-hmm.
I think it depends.
On your agreement.
I think it on your agreement.
Mm-hmm. And so you let's go to what you thought I'd said. Let's go to adult children moving back into the home. I would think this would be one of the most fraught situations of all, because certainly in this culture, it's usually not something that's taken willingly.
Well, you know, in our generation, that's, I assume you're sort of more or less my age, in our generation, that's true. What I'm witnessing in the young people who are in their 20s, they don't have the same kind of sense about it that we had. It's not that failure or, you know, oh my God, I have to live with my parents. It's kind of like, yep, living with my parents. I think for the parents, might be a little like, oh, I thought they were gone. But I think that what's difficult here is that the parents and the kids need to make the transition from parent-kid to adults living together. And that kids need, if they can't pick up a financial component, but many of them do. Many of them contribute because they're helping their parents out, too. They at least need to realize that there's a certain amount of maintenance work that goes on in keeping a home going, from vacuuming to washing dishes to shopping to shoveling, and they need to contribute.
Now, you have a quote, actually, on the cover of your book, Sharing Housing, by Bill McKibben. He's the environmental journalist. He's the founder of 350.org, which is an organization that's working to bring carbon emissions back down to a safe mm-hmm. level. Why does he have a quote on the cover of your book?
Because he's, well, there's a number of different reasons, but there is an aspect to this whole business about sharing housing that has to do with being sustainable. Obviously, people under one roof, instead of in two separate houses, are using less fuel and resources to keep a house warm and lit and so on. It's also true that you just need less stuff. If you're in a house with other people, somebody owns the toaster, somebody owns the microwave, somebody owns the TV, somebody else owns a couch. You just don't have to provide for yourself all of the accoutrement that American life now has to it. So I think that's part of what Bill was seeing. I think he also saw that the way that we've been living in McMansions in suburbia, in this kind of consumer culture, is not really healthy for us. And that's sort of what I'm thinking, too, that we need people. We need to be more connected to each other. And we live in a society that's very difficult to do, particularly if you're living alone and you're not connected to a large group somehow. So by living under a roof, we are able to have a sense of the community that human beings have always had. You know, we used to live in tribes of 50 to 200 people. It's not really very natural to be living alone in the way that we do. And so I'm hoping my book will be a practical guide for something that's much bigger.
That was Anna Marie Pluhar. Her book is Shared Housing, a guidebook to finding and keeping good housemates. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to Pluhar's website on sharing housing. There, you can fill out a questionnaire that will help you clarify what you need and don't need when looking for housemates. It's also chock full of other helpful information. Next up, help for hoarders and for the rest of us who need to get rid of the clutter. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As viewers of the A&E TV show Hoarders know, more than 3 million people suffer from the psychological disorder hoarding. While many of us can feel beset by too much stuff and too little time to deal with it, hoarding is a clinical disorder that goes way beyond ordinary clutter. It can lead to homes that are layered with an archaeological ruins worth of garbage or crowds of pets too many to take care of hygienically. It can ruin the lives not only of hoarders, but also their families. It leads to shame and isolation. Society looks on hoarders with contempt, but its roots lie in trauma, in fear and anxiety. Hoarders need our compassion. And for those of us who have relatives who are on the hoarding spectrum, we can only help them if we understand and treat them with kindness. My guest, Dr. Robin Zasio, is a clinical psychologist specializing in treating anxiety and related disorders. She's a featured doctor on the A&E hit series Hoarders, currently filming its fourth season. And Dr. Robin Zasio, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I was very, very interested to read your book, and it's very non-judgmental, I found. I think people have a very negative view of hoarders, but you don't.
Well, you know, this is the thing. You know, I think that it's so easy to look at somebody else's situation and judge them and say, how could you, and what's wrong with you, rather than realizing that, you know, compulsive hoarding is a mental health condition, and if you can separate it out, you know, no different than depression, you know? I mean, people, I don't think, by and large, choose to be depressed, just like people don't choose to become a compulsive hoarder. And if we can look at it from that frame and then approach them with understanding and compassion, we're much more apt to be able to help them rather than to be angry and, as you mentioned, judgmental and, you know, that sort of thing.
What is compulsive hoarding? What's the difference between compulsive hoarding and, you know, the kind of cluttered whatnot drawers that most of us probably have in our homes?
With any problem, there's a continuum. And so the book is designed to help people understand that all of us can sort of fall prey to some of the cognitive distortions that we see in people that are struggling with compulsive hoarding more on that severe level. And it really becomes what I would say diagnostically a problem when you're bringing in more stuff than your house can hold. You can't use areas of your house for the purpose that they're intended. You know, you have difficulty cooking because there's stuff all over the counters and you're tripping over things, or you can't sleep in your bed because it's covered with stuff. You know, family members are starting to get irritated because their space is being taken over. And so, you know, while clutter can have that same impact, we're talking about compulsive hoarding. We're really talking about an inability to use these areas. And so much so that the stuff continues to pile up and acquire to where, you know, you're embarrassed to bring people in because you are insightful enough to know that people are going to start to wonder what's going on. And, you know, I think start to fear that people are going to judge them. On top of that, what happens is the house starts to deteriorate where they're not going to bring in, you know, repair people when things start to break down. And that's when we really see problems start to happen.
You begin your book, Robin Zasio, with a case of a woman who, on the outside and outside of her home, looks pretty well put together. You know, she's got holds down a good job. She's neat. She looks like she's doing fine. Mm-hmm. And then you go to her home. Tell us about her.
Well, the reality is that, you know, again, we talked about this problem being on a continuum, and there's some people that have insight and know that they have a problem, but can still function outside of their home. And so it's this irony of they can go to work and they can be organized and a great employee, but then when it comes to their home, they have other issues going on, and this was very much the case. Oftentimes, there are psychological factors more times than not, actually, that drive the behavior, oftentimes trauma, grief and loss, whereby a person can't deal with those feelings. And so oftentimes going out shopping is a distraction. And then when they're not engaging in that behavior and the feelings start to surface again, they want to distract, and so they go out and they engage in, you know, whether it be shopping behaviors or yard sales or, you know, acquiring, even digging in dumpsters, which was not the case with this woman, but they're just finding something to distract because the pain of dealing with the feelings of the reality of their real life can just be too much.
You talked about cognitive distortions. What are some of the cognitive distortions that are typical of compulsive hoarding?
The most common ones are, for instance, if somebody is out shopping, and let's say there's an item for $15 that's on sale for $3.99. They'll say things like, oh my gosh, this is such a good deal. You know, I can't pass this up, and if I do, I'll always forever regret it. And so they purchase it, even though perhaps it's not an item that they need, but they think it's such a good deal, and if they pass it up, it will forever haunt them. And so they'll bring it home, even though it's not an item that they can use. And so what I try to point out in the book is that this is a distortion that it's such a good deal because it's something that you don't need that you will never use. So you've actually just paid $3.99 plus tax for something that you won't use. So you've actually lost money. So that's just one. On top of that, I think another common one, and, you know, as you read about my makeup drawer, I fell prey to this in the sense that, you know, gosh, this could be usable. This eyeliner or this lipstick could be usable in the future, even though I haven't used it in 20 years. It's not likely it's going to be usable because, one, when it comes down to it, I'm not going to want to put makeup on my face that's 20 years old. But in the moment, we can again fall prey to these cognitive distortions, thinking that if I throw it away, I will regret it, because if at some point I, you know, am going to dress up, you know, in a Halloween costume and I need black eyeliner, I'm going to regret that I threw it away. So we fall prey into these thinking distortions that are anxiety-driven, and we give into them.
Yeah, and the makeup drawer you're referring to, you actually had this kind of moment of truth when you were on your way out to a client who had a hoarding problem, and you opened up your makeup drawer and noticed that you had all this stuff that you hadn't used even in 20 years.
Right, right. Now, keep in mind, you know, again, as we talk about the continuum, and this book is meant for those such as me who have this makeup drawer where every time I open it up, I go, oh, I hate looking at this stuff. Why can't I throw it away? Again, to the person on the extreme end who's swimming in stuff. And it's not interfering with my life in the sense that when I walk in the bathroom, I'm not overwhelmed by thinking about that makeup drawer. But it causes this angst, if you will, or this emotion, these emotions when I open up the drawer going, why can't I throw it away? And so we all are human in the sense that we can get attached for one reason or another to our possessions. And, you know, I'm not saying that that makeup drawer is unhealthy for me because, again, I'm talking about it now and then I think, oh, that darn makeup drawer. But I don't think about it on a daily basis. And so basically this book is designed to help people understand where are you attached to your stuff, and could that drawer or that closet be used for something else incoming that you actually do use. That makeup drawer is so small, it's so tiny, that it's not like, you know, I open up my closet and I've got, you know, 20 years of makeup. That's not the situation. But again, it's sort of saying, why can't I let go? And the reality that when I'm standing there working with a compulsive hoarder, those same thoughts that go through their mind run through my mind, but on a much lesser scale.
And we could all use some of that help. How do people get to be compulsive hoarders? I mean, you've talked about some of them, trauma, but you also have some things in the book about disorganization. And this was a new idea to me that, that, you know, people like myself who have ADHD, you know, we might fall prey to some of these problems. Maybe we're not compulsive hoarders, but we accumulate a lot of stuff because we're disorganized.
Right, right. And that's where, you know, some of the tips and strategies in the book are designed to help people in terms of where does your disorganization lie? For instance, towards the end of the book, it talks about, you know, are you a visual person where you do better with cabinets that don't have doors on it so you can kind of see your stuff? Or are you somebody better who does better with putting things in drawers? And to look at why you're not able to then apply those skills. What happens for you when you come home that you feel that it's easier to sort of put it off and procrastinate, which is a huge theme in the book? What's going on that, you know, there's always things that are easier to do in the moment rather than the harder things. And that's probably for all of us in life with respect to, you know, I'd rather put it off, I'd rather do it later. But I'm really trying to help people understand that if you do things in the moment and make sure that anything that you bring into your home has a home, which is not, you know, in a bag by the front door or on the coffee table, that if you can do things in the moment, you actually save time in the long run. And when your brain goes to that place where it says, you know, let's do it later or I don't have time, those, again, I'm going to sort of venture out to say are cognitive distortions. You probably do have time in that moment to take that bag into the kitchen and unload the grocery, the groceries. But we get into these traps of, you know, our own brain that talks us out of things.
We're talking with Dr. Robin Zacio about her book, The Hoarder in You, How to Live a Happier, Healthier, Uncluttered Life. One of the problems I have is being able to know how to categorize things. I find that I can have like three or four different filing systems and then, you know, I can't find something, so I try to go and replace it and then the clutter happens.
Right. And one of the biggest traps that people fall into is reinventing the wheel. Having these grand schemes of, oh, I'm going to reorganize this or I'm going to reorganize that. And I think that it really goes back to identifying a system that works for you. For instance, if it's receipts, do you work better with respect to having different categories of receipts, for instance, groceries, clothing, and that kind of thing, or do you work better to have one file that is just under receipts? And so, you know, it really takes a thoughtful process in the beginning to sort of sit down, lay everything out, and think about how, you know, if you're thinking about going back to the concept of receipts, are you more apt to do better with just having one file where everything's in there or to break them down? And for every person, it's going to be different.
Now, here's another problem that I saw in your book and I recognized in myself, and I think probably a lot of other people who like to live green have this problem, and that is that, you know, when you don't have really adequate recycling systems, you don't want to throw things away because you don't want to add to the waste stream. So what might be some suggestions you would have about that?
This is a big problem, and, you know, I fall prey to this, too, at times. This is the deal. My book is designed, as the title implies, How to Live a Happier, Healthier, Uncluttered Life. And I think that all of us have to go into that balance to say, do I want to get stuck on recycling, which means my house is going to be cluttered because I have nowhere to put it, or would I rather be, you know, live an uncluttered life and just go ahead and put this stuff in the garbage, right? I mean, you have to make a decision at some point. On the other hand, what I would say is that it's so important to continue to remember to do things in the moment. So what I mean by that is if you are somebody who's really a recycler, you think it's important, which is great for the environment, then when I say do things in the moment, put things by the front door if you don't have any place outside, and when you leave that day, take that bag with you and then go to a place and dump it off where it can be recycled. And that's that whole concept of if you do things in the moment and not procrastinate, then it doesn't pile up. But you have to have a plan. It's no different than going through your closet and thinking, okay, you know what, I can declutter this closet, and you do, and you come up with three bags of Goodwill. But if it sits by the door, that's not a good plan. So make a plan on Saturday or a specific day to actually take it to Goodwill so that, again, it doesn't clutter up.
Now, for people who are friends and family members of compulsive hoarders or even just people who live in extreme clutter, what are some of the do's and don'ts of talking to them to help them out of this? Because I also saw, you know, you talked about some of the don'ts, and I know that those are the things that I've tried on my family member, and they didn't work.
Well, you know, this is kind of, you know, what I would say where the rubber meets the road. I mean, you know, a person has to identify that there's a problem. And, you know, isn't that the truth with anything in life? If we deny that we have a problem, whether it be with our organization, whether it be with our anger, whether it be with our communication, then we can't address it. And so, you know, the don'ts, as you've seen, are the nagging and the badgering and the throwing away other people's stuff and yelling. That you're not going to get anywhere, because with any of that behavior, defenses are going to come up and there's not going to be any communication.
I didn't go to that extreme, but I did say things like, well, I did actually throw things away. But, you know, I would just say things like, but you really don't need this. You have 10 others of these. You haven't really used this in 10 years.
Yeah, Francesca, that's one of the biggest traps too, because the bottom line is you're telling somebody what's important and not important to them, right? And so defenses are going to go up when you're saying you don't need this. It's no different than you walking into my office and looking at, let's say, a picture of my dog and saying, you don't need this picture. Well, you know, who are you to tell me I don't need that, right? And so if something is important to me and somebody's telling me it's not, immediately I would get defensive. So I think the key is to say, I'm concerned that your stuff may be interfering with your life, or I'm having a hard time because, you know, your stuff is now coming into my room and it's starting to cause clutter for me. So trying to use lots of I statements so that the person can hopefully hear how you're feeling rather than feeling like they're being attacked or judged. And again, telling them that they have 10 other things. They know that they have 10 other things, you know, or 10 others of that item. Basically, what it comes down to is talking with them in a way that helps them to feel like you're concerned about them and compassionate to the situation, and even asking them whether or not they're concerned about it. Ultimately, I use compassion and understanding. I help to educate them, and sometimes it goes nowhere, and sometimes people just have to kind of get really sick and tired of being sick and tired before they'll acknowledge that there's a problem.
We're talking with Dr. Robin Zazio. She's one of the lead psychologists on the show Hoarders. I asked her to tell us about the show.
The show is about helping people who are in severe crisis. Code enforcement has been called. They have children who cannot, you know, make meals, sleep in their beds. You know, CPS is a threat, Adult Protective Services, the health department. And so we go in, and while we realize we cannot declutter their house in 2 days, which is typically the amount of time that we have, the idea is that we are going to help them resolve the crisis and get their home in a place that is safe for them, and then they can continue to use the aftercare funds that we provide for them to continue to work on the problem.
So if you could pick out one example of maybe the most challenging one that you had on the show, Hoarders, what was that?
Gosh, Francesca, I don't know that I can, you know, sort of do a search in my memory bank in terms of what was the most challenging. I mean, you know, I've had people that I've worked with that just put up a big wall, even though they've actually said, yes, come help me, and then we get there, and then they say, sorry, not going to work with you. And then there's other people where they will just be in tears saying, thank you, I'm so grateful, and I can't believe I let my house get this bad. One such case, if you will, was a woman who was a doll hoarder. And if you look at her home, it was almost surreal because she had thousands and thousands of dolls. And when you walk in, you just see eyes looking at you everywhere. And they were stacked and piled on one another. And literally, you know, she thought that she was a doll collector. because, you know, she would spend all this time on the computer, in her mind, researching and getting all these dolls. But the bottom line is there's a difference between a collection and someone who's a hoarder. A collection you can display. There's thought that goes in. You might resell dolls to make room for more and for more dolls. And, you know, you can enjoy them. In this case, they were getting destroyed and trampled on. The house was overrun by them. But when we got there and we were able to educate her about these differences and about the impact in her life and the reality that she had health problems, her husband had health problems, and there was no way if either one of them had an emergency that emergency crews could come in, she got it. And ultimately, her house is now in order because she was able to understand that she really had a problem.
And what drew you to this yourself? I mean, do you have hoarding in your background?
I do not have any hoarding. In fact, I'm a very organized and meticulous person. I'm definitely somebody where if my environment, whether it be car, work, or home, if it's out of order, I feel emotionally out of order, if you will. And again, that's a theme in the book. I got into this because my specialty is in treating somebody who has a primary diagnosis of an anxiety disorder. And while compulsive hoarding isn't something that officially falls under anxiety disorders, it is completely driven by fear and anxiety. And so it's sort of what we call a spectrum disorder. And so that's how I got into it.
A spectrum disorder.
Mm-hmm. A spectrum. So it's sort of on a continuum, if you will, or a spectrum of anxiety.
Right. You know, I did tell the person that I've been referring to, my family member, that I was going to interview you. And I said to her, you know, the theory is that this is driven by anxiety. And she said, oh, yes.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's all about fear. If I don't purchase this item, if I don't get this item at the garage sale, I'm going to regret it. And then on the back end, the acquiring and having things on the, in the home, it's if I let this go, I'm always going to regret it. So, you know, I mean, if you think about it, our lives in many ways on an unconscious level are driven by anxiety. If I don't set the alarm, I won't wake up and I could, you know, be late for work or even be fired. You know, I mean, literally, if I don't, you know, stop at this stoplight, you know, I could get into an accident. And so we don't think about it in that kind of conscious way. But the reality is that we are motivated by it. And it's healthy. We have to have anxiety to survive. It's just when it gets, like the compulsive hoarder, when it becomes a mental health condition and it begins to interfere with your life, that's really when it needs to be attended to.
Now, Dr. Robin Zacio, in your clinic, you have a 6-week intensive outpatient program. Could you talk a little bit about that program and what does it cover?
The program is intensive outpatient. It's Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. until 1 p.m., and we see people that come literally all over the world to address their anxiety symptoms. And the reason why we developed this program is that we recognize that there are some people who have more mild symptoms that can benefit from the treatment, you know, coming once a week and then being able to do the homework on their own. For others, their symptoms are more moderate to extreme, where they really need a lot more guidance and a therapist-assisted support to do the work. Ultimately, at the end of the day, everything that we do is called exposure therapy. You're confronting your fear by facing it down. And sometimes it's just a little bit too difficult to do on your own, which is why we developed that program.
Could you give an example, I mean, of what do you expose people to?
We have a large portion of people that suffer from obsessive compulsive disorder. So, for instance, it's not uncommon that people will come in, they shower on the average 6 to 9 hours a day. And so basically we work with them to start cutting down the amount of time that they spend in the shower, literally by having them shower in the clinic. Of course, we're not in the shower with them, but, you know, through talking with them on the other side of the door, we can oftentimes get people to go from 9 hours to 45 minutes in a very short period of time, and then we cut it down to the point where we actually get them to go a 24-hour period without showering at all. And it's a desensitization process where we're trying to get them to a place where they can sit with the feeling of being uncomfortable feeling dirty or feeling contaminated. And the more that you confront your fear, what happens is the fear actually comes down.
And how would that work with somebody who has a hoarding problem in your clinic? I mean, how do you desensitize them?
There's two ways. In the beginning, we do a very thorough assessment to uncover, you know, all the factors that are contributing to the hoarding behavior and ensure that there's no other diagnoses going on that we need to address. Then, once they're ready to start decluttering, we have them start bringing in items, boxes, bags, whatever it is, to start teaching them to be thoughtful in this process and beginning to understand the thinking that goes behind the item. So, you know, if someone picks up a piece of paper and it has a phone number on it, and they have no idea what that phone number is, you know, we're going to ask them, so why are you holding on to this? Talk to me about what your thinking process is so that we can help them to break it down. And then once we've had them bring in a number of items so we can start that process of helping them to break down their thinking, we start to actually go to their home and work in their home environment.
Well, it sounds great. Now, you have a couple of tips, 5 ways to beat clutter. Maybe we don't have time to do all 5, but give us a couple of those ways that maybe that we haven't covered already that we ordinary people who sometimes deal with clutter, how can we beat it?
The first thing that I would say would be to develop a schedule of decluttering. You know, if you just have this sort of, oh, I need to declutter my house with no plan to do it or any schedule, typically it doesn't happen. So I would say start with making a plan of decluttering. And then the second piece is to start with the easier places first. Oftentimes people don't really have a strategy and they can go to the biggest areas of clutter rather than the smaller areas. Make it manageable. Don't set aside a day necessarily to declutter as it is. Work with who you are as a person. Some people say a day would work great for me. For other people, you know, maybe it's an hour on Saturday, an hour on Sunday. So again, I'd say the first place to start is making a plan and starting with the easier places first, and then that makes the more difficult areas in terms of making decisions a lot easier.
Oh, that's great. And I can attest that it works because I've started to do it. And it's so nice to be in a room that is decluttered. Well, Dr. Robin Zasio, your book is The Hoarder in You, How to Live a Happier, Healthier, Uncluttered Life. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Francesca. It's been such a pleasure.
Dr. Robin Zasio is a clinical psychologist specializing in treating anxiety disorders. She founded and directed the Anxiety Treatment Center, the Cognitive Behavior Therapy Center, and the Compulsive Hoarding Center in Sacramento, California. Zasio is a featured doctor on the A&E hit series, Hoarders. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.